Okay, so I will speak about two topics. One is about traffic jamming and asymmetric exclusion process, which links to localization of polymers in a random medium with a delta function potential. And the second one is about loops in 2D KPZ. Both topics are a little bit older. It's not my current stuff in the sense that this is 2003 and this is 2001. So. Okay, but they link more, I think, better to what is going on in this workshop than what I'm doing now with clustering and asymmetric exclusion processes and so on. And I particularly want to talk about the second one, hopefully in the end, because it links, I think, to what's going on last week with when we talk about turbulence and also about the spin glasses. And so the first topic is this stuff with my student Mi Soon and Jussi Timonen from Finland. And it's 1D KPZ stuff. So, and I think most people you know, if the 1D KPZ is equivalent to an ASAP process and to polymer localization in 2D, it's also connected to an equilibrium facet. This is facet rich and the endpoints. If you have, you can map the six vertex model version of the KPZ onto an equilibrium system in 2D, and then that the KPZ is realized as the edge of the endpoint of an ridge of two facets. Here is rough, so this is conformal field here. This is Luttinger liquid Z equals 1. Here is non-relativistic electrons, and here is that KPZ point. And but I won't talk about that today. So I'm wobbling around in these three representations. The topic came out of the slow combustion of paper, experiments, the question. So I will first talk a little bit about experiments because it's nice to talk about experiments every now and then. And then we did a simulation strictly in the asymmetric exclusion language. But since I think the reason for talking here is more about, there are some experts here, I think, about the polymer stuff. And I'm saying basically something that seems heresy, I think, compared to what people think or thought before that. Okay, and so I will go from here to there and then to there. So here's a 1D interface as function of time. It starts flat and it roughens slowly. And this 1D KPZ. And this is actually experimental data. No. Okay. I will show you. Okay, now KPZ, everybody here knows, I can skip this, isn't it? that stuff too. Remember, so the roughness exponent, I used to go alpha, and the dynamic exponent is that, and so on. So I can skip this one too. So here's this slow combustion of paper. So go too fast? Okay. Okay, then we'll go slow. Okay, so this is the KPZ Langevin equation. For a growing interface, you have the height with respect to a reference, whatever it is. I'll call it x here. Okay. And so it grows in the Langevin equation at a constant rate plus some modification given by the local topography of the current surface plus random noise and correlated noise. And so this tells you that if you have a little valley here, then it grows a little bit faster here because the curve here is positive. Hilltops grow slower. And this tells you there's a modification with respect to the slope. If there's a sloped area, then it grows faster or slower depending on the value of lambda. And I will give you some lattice models later, the BCSLS model and the RSLS model, Kim Koslet's model, and then the lambda actually is negative. Well, in the Burgers equation, you would choose this to be plus one. Okay. And then it is known for a while now, in one plus one dimension, that, for example, here the interface width, the moments of the interface profile in the stationary state or a function of time. And this is only one thing you can measure. And so it's characterized by the dynamic exponent. This is how fast fluctuations die out and move around. And the finite size scaling of the equilibrium state. And then this, it turns out that in 1D, with periodic boundary conditions, the stationary state here is completely disordered. So if you walk along this growing surface and at long times, and you walk along the surface, it's like a random walk. It's a completely uncorrelated state. Okay, and this is actually somewhat disappointing, because if you want to study non-equilibrium driven systems, then you expect complicated stationary states with all type of long-range interactions and all that stuff. But unlike if you have now a random walk surface, like an equilibrium surface, would have exactly the same stationary state. But if you would make a fluctuation there, then the fluctuation in the equilibrium case would spread out as time to the 1 over that. So that is done in equilibrium, that is Z equals 2, that's Gaussian. And here it turns out to be 3 halves.
So we're in one dimension.
In one dimension at the moment, okay? And there's another aspect of it that is there sometimes, I'll show you later, on this, there's a group velocity of this fluctuation. If you make a fluctuation, it not necessarily stands still. So it depends on the slope of the surface. And so it can be moving left or to the left or forward, and that will play an important role later on.
Okay, so
here is, let me maybe go first here. So these are experiments, there are actually only a few experimental systems that have been shown to belong to this, and it's nice to have one, okay, or two actually, I'll mention. So these are experiments by UC Timonen in Finland. So it's a piece of paper this wide, that long. And you see the boundary condition is always very important. So you see he has very carefully dealt with the boundary condition. Because KPC is very unstable with the boundary things. When if you, this is just copy paper or lens paper of different weights. And he dopes it, so to say, with potassium nitrate. Otherwise it would go up in flames and you want to have flameless combustion. And so he basically sets, it lights it on one end, and like a cigarette paper, the thing will start to burn. And then you get this type of snapshot if you put a video recorder above it. And this is the progressing interface.
The real model is parallel.
Hmm?
All the snapshots, the bounce is parallel, it's horizontal.
Yes.
So like
because it.
Should be horizontal.
It's a function of time.
It doesn't look very well.
No, but why should it? But that is not actually unsuspected. If you go to the old equilibrium roughness stuff in two dimension, then that is a logarithmic roughness, and actually that will hardly show up actually in the picture.
This is 1D.
This is 1D, so it's a little bit rougher, but not that rough. Okay, and one of the problems is there is a length scale. The paper has some impurities of roughly half a millimeter, half centimeter. And that is this crossover type things. So he actually has, if this is 20 centimeters, then he has only, and the cutoff is roughly at a half, then he has basically only 40. So the weakness of the experiment is that you don't have many decades of scanning. And let me show you some, here's the experiment. So they have a table here that can rotate because you get worried about convection and all type of things.
Do you make a connection with and Schwann?
Yeah, that will come. But this, of course, has viscosity. Yeah? The curvature term is there, and therefore you don't see sharp shock waves all around it. That was the discussion last week.
From top to bottom?
No, this from bottom to top.
So that's beginning.
That's the beginning, yeah. Okay, now you repeat this many, many times. Okay. Roughly around a few hundred. Because he knows to do statistics.
So we don't see any shock waves?
No, because the viscosity is there, okay? So that's why. But we'll get back to that. Okay, so then he measures things like the time correlations at the same site, just in time in the stationary state. This is not the stationary, this is from flat. And that way you can measure the dynamic exponent, which comes up for some bad exponent, so that is half over z. And it should be 1/3.
Each X is a gradient point X,
right? Yes. So you have these things here. So he basically takes a correlation like that. The same spot as function of time. Yeah? And this should scale as a power law, starting from flat, with embed exponent 1/3, because Z is 3/2 and alpha is 1/2. And then here is that 1/2 centimeter length scale. Beneath it, it is propagation of a front in the presence of random impurities. So that is more like some of you guys are doing. So this should scale of a different exponent. This is the KPC domain, from 1/2 centimeter to 20 or so. Looks more like 30.
So what are these two state lines?
This should decay as a power, go as a power law, the width, yeah, so it increases a power law, so you do a log plot, and the slope is the exponent beta.
And you have two straight, curved.
Yes, there's a crossover,
yeah.
And the crossover comes about because there is at small length scales, smaller than 0.5 centimeter, they have basically random impurities.
No, my question is you have two straight lines.
Now, this is the regime where there's a propagating front in the presence of random impurities.
The slope is 1/2, and then 2/3 sometimes?
This is 2/3, yeah.
And to the right?
To the right, I see. Do I have it in the other one? I forgot now what. Yes, it's not experiments at this point. That is the other one. Yes, and this is now. This is a different one. This is the next one. In case you want to measure the two exponents, yeah, the dynamic exponent and the roughness exponent. Yeah, no, I'm trying to find it.
The average value depends on time, right?
Yes. So you start from a flat surface, and then you let it roughen.
But you subtract h bar times t plus delta t, right?
Because you want to subtract the average growth rate. So this is the same thing that Spohn was writing down, okay? It is like h, so you start from a flat surface, so something like h0. And then you get c1 times time, that is just the average speed, and that is subtracted here. And then you get C2 and then T 1/3, and then you got that the Tracy Whittam distribution, that type of thing. Okay, and so basically we plot doing this in the form of a correlation.
What's your first regime?
That is quenched KPC.
So
the
three different curves,
three different type of paper. This is the, I forgot now which one because it's not my experiment.
It looks like the slopes are slightly different.
Now the lens paper actually was so smooth that there is not much stochasticity. Yeah, that's as if the noise is very weak and therefore you have to wait much longer, and actually that experiment didn't go too well. And the other two are a different weight type of just copy paper that you buy in the store. And that those two, I believe. Okay, so actually the random noise is generated by the same impurities that pin the surface at this length scales. Beta is supposed to be 1/3 and it comes out. Okay, here's a table. Let's see, where is it?
Sorry, just to be clear, the random impurity problem, is that understood? Is it known where it should be or not?
This one?
Yeah.
I think it's also understood, but understood. There are some people here who know better, I think. Than I do.
Oh, it's the same thing in a random
impurity. That's just. So here then, so here's now a correlation along the surface in the stationary state. Quite long time. That should give you the roughness, and this should be 1/2, so this should go linear, and then you see the same crossover, and you can determine the alpha, and it should be 1/2. Okay, now let me see where was my. And so here are then the data they publish. So this roughness exponent is 1/2. This is a different type of paper. Beta is. See, this one is not very good. This is the lens paper, and he measured also the coupling constant in the KPC. And then there are these crossover time scales and where the KPC starts. Okay, now this is a very similar experiment in the sense of the data looks very similar. That is Rinke Weingart in Amsterdam. So he has an a moving interface in a high TC superconductor between the normal and the superconducting phase. And this is moving, and he gets basically very similar results. I don't remember how he measured that. But actually, the two groups were talking to each other at the time because they have the same type of problems with impurities, and they have the same. Okay, so so this whole thing I'm going to talk about is started with actually UC came to Seattle on sabbatical, and he said I'm basically done with this. It was, yeah. And so I did one more experiment. Remember this surface is doped with potassium nitrate, so you can actually in a very narrow band you could overdope it a little bit, make the concentration larger or smaller, and then the surface will grow faster here. And it will facet. Okay, so here's the same type of time evolution. And you see that the surface starts to get something like a cusp. Okay, and of course you can do it over below the under or over dope. Then you do again averaging over many burns, and then you get something that looks smoother, of course. And now the question is, what is it supposed to be? Now it is asymmetric. It is asymmetric because that's the nonlinear term in the KPC. This was in Gaussian particle holes, whatever the symmetric thing, then there would be no difference. So he used it as an example of showing there is a nonlinear term in the thing.
Sorry, what is the term in the KPC that is locally changed by
it? I will show you. That is
for a gradient squared. Which one is changed by the presence of this potassium?
It is the nonlinear term, I think, and the other one. Okay, I will show you. Okay, I will show you how we model it. Okay. Yeah. But it is everything is changed actually, I think. Okay. Because I will model it as a slow bond in the ASA. Okay. Now the question is, what is the shape supposed to be? Yeah. And and then if you look at the early papers on the mean field theory, it says it should facet for overdoping. And this should be a logarithmic thing if it was underdoped. That is mean field theory. But that is clearly not correct. And then it turns out there's a whole literature about this from the mid-90s in a different context. Okay. And but I admit I didn't really know all that stuff too well. Okay. So I just jumped into it and said, okay, we're going to measure it. Okay. I'm just going to simulate it in the ASAP language. If I had known all the literature about it, then I probably might have chosen not to do it, okay? But I end up with an answer that seems to contradict what people think. Okay, now this is an experimental curve here. Okay. Let's forget about it. So let me explain first what this has to do with the random walker and the polymer in the. And otherwise, you probably lose interest. So first, now this. Okay, so this is equivalent to having this polymer bubbling around in a random medium with a delta function potential in the middle, attractive. And the faceting actually implies that it is localized. The standard way that goes.
Connect.
I will do that. Well, come here. Well, come here. Here's the KPC equation.
But I think the
positive
comes actually in forcing term, eta.
No, the eta is ruled by those impurities.
Yeah, but you put more impurities in the middle.
No, the impurities are part of the paper.
So what do you put there in the middle?
The speed. So these two terms are changed.
No, but what physically you put in the middle?
You soak it with potassium. Soak it with potassium nitrate.
Well, it means that you change the propagation rate. The
yes, but it is not so much in the noise you're changing. You're changing these two terms. Okay. So this is the standard way of connecting KPC to the random walk problem. So you do the Kolb-Hopf transformation like this. We've seen this last week too. And then this, if you do the transformation on this, this goes back to the Stone Age, Perkins and so on. And this nonlinear term, that is the problem here, transforms into vanishes, but you pay a price for it, you get multiplicative noise. And this is, so this is a Schrodinger equation in Euclidean time of a particle, a kinetic energy term, and then a random potential, random in time and space, and uncorrelated. And so this is standard stuff. Okay, and then it goes back to Carter and so on in the 70s, that if you have a random walker in this landscape of random potentials, and then it spreads out, not with 1/2 power, as it would be normally if there was no random noise, but with the 1/3, 2/3 part of 1/3, 2/3. Okay, and that is the way KPZ, the dynamic exponent of KPZ, shows up in this type of problem. And so what we now do is nothing else than basically putting a slow bond here. That is the slow bond, or this means that there is a delta function potential here, basically.
It's not spread out. It just moves from this distance, but it doesn't spread out.
Uh-huh. Yes, the fluctuation.
Contrary to the diffusive behavior.
Yeah. With 2/3 instead of...
I mean, the variance will not be 2/3, it will not be t to the third, it will be constant. So it doesn't spread out, it just moves at this distance, but it mm-hmm. doesn't spread out.
Spread more quickly.
Yeah.
No, it moves farther away, but it doesn't spread out. That's what this is really like.
In time, it's just one point.
Right? Say it again? Ali. You move for the distance of order t to the 2/3, yes. But when you look how much you spread out, it's very little. It's constant spread.
You mean the Hamiltonian fluctuation,
For positive temperature, yes.
Yeah.
But isn't that it's important to say that it's not spread out, it's just moving.
Okay, well, what's my language? Okay, so effectively what we do by doping it along that line in the KPZ is by having a delta function type potential here. Okay? And now the question is whether a random walker like that is localized to this fly paper or not. Okay, and there is basically, it had been studied in the mid-90s, and you don't have it here somewhere. Okay, so there are a lot of people connected to it. I think the point is basically that people think that the KPZ fixed point, they know, in 1D. And the idea is that, it comes out of it, that this type of delta function potential is like on its lower critical dimension, exactly in 1. Which means that I would expect at best an essential singularity of some type, some crossover phenomenon. Okay, and I'm going to say something else. I'm going to say that there's a critical strength of this. So let me just write down what I'm going to say. And so I'm going to say there is a critical... let's write this down. And so we have this. Let's call it 1 minus r, that's for a reason to come in a delta function potential. Okay. And I write it like this because that is the notation later on. But I'm going to say that between 1 and a critical value, which is not universal, so I don't have to specify it here. In fact, it's 0.8 in my other model, it's not important. I'm going to say that this guy is basically going like nu, and the nu is 1/3. Well, only if the r is smaller, if it's stronger, let's see now.
That's strong.
Yeah. Then it is going to be exponentially localized. Okay? And so the fact that there is a critical point in between from a stretched type localization to a normal localization, that comes out of the numerics. I'm going to show it.
But power counting is marginal, it's presumably marginally relevant if you just do perturbation theory.
Okay, but so how to reconcile the numerics with field theory is left public. I will show you this, okay? I will show you the numerics and
the same behavior,
it's always localized, but in a stretched way. Okay, so for example, there are old numerics by Carter and Condell, I think it was, where they showed that the thing remained localized, but I think their numerics was not careful enough to be able to distinguish between some such things. Okay? Are you? No, I will give you an argument for. Okay, you do the power counting. Okay, I will show you numerically that it happens, and I can have an argument in the end for this. Okay.
If you multiply it by white noise in time, yeah, would it be the same effect on that? So there is this, you have two potentials.
You want white noise for the for this one?
Yeah.
No, this is fixed.
So that's different.
That doesn't, it's not noisy now.
But there is some interaction between this and your current.
Well, this is like a fly paper. The fly paper is there, okay?
This brown curve.
This?
Yes, what I'm supposed to do is the equation to find the brown curve.
That is the wave function or the distribution function of the particle.
Wave function usually is not depicted by a curve.
No, but this is one space-time trajectory of okay, of the path integral of the particle, okay? One.
It's maximum of the wave function.
Yeah, yeah. But if this is an if you interpret this as a polymer, that's the partition function of a polymer in 2D, then this is one snapshot of the polymer.
But mathematically, it's a maximal bubble.
No, it is one realization in a simulation of a Feynman path integral.
Yeah,
Precisely. A typical configuration. Yeah. okay, but okay. This picture is not necessarily accurate, but that is better. Mm-hmm.
Can you
write
one typical?
What is one? I cannot reproduce that here, but some of you. That is what people say. Yeah. No, because it looked to me complicated when I was reading it 3 years ago.
You can have localization both in dimension 1 and 2 for small interfaces. If you had a little better function, only dimension 1 and 2 would have localization. 3 you would not say that.
Yeah, but that's for normal localization, eh? That's different.
So this is critical dimension for your effect, for this phase transition. For that phase transition, for this phase transition which you detect.
Yeah, maybe I should go on first and give you the numerical evidence, and then we can discuss more. No, because by the time I discussed the model carefully in the ASAP language, it is more that's more specifically defined, and the discussion gets more focused, I think. Okay? Okay, so now what does it mean here? And okay, so basically my student just finished a case where he had an ASAP process with a parking garage and some fun with microscopic occupation of parking garages. Let me first, so let me do the mapping first between here and there. So here's the same thing as we saw before, that is the KPZ equation again, and that is exactly the same view. Again, as most people know here, that if you take the gradient of the scalar field and you get a velocity type field, And then this KPC equation transforms into the Burgers equation, where then this lambda is supposed to be 1, typically. Or does it make any difference actually? Okay. If you are in one dimension, then you can you don't have to talk about it. This is not a vector field, because this is a scalar, and the gradient is a scalar. And then you can just as well think this as a velocity, but as a density. And then you can talk about the flow, driven flow, by this type of thing, and the constant term, which I threw out, in a narrow channel. And so that's how that goes. And here's a specific way of doing it on the lattice, which is that spin and half quantum chain game that Spohn was talking about too. So here is one of the realization of KPZ in one dimension, the brick layer model, with the bricks on the side. And the condition is that you can throw bricks down with probability P if there's a valley, and evaporate with a smaller probability Q if there's a hilltop. But the nearest neighbors have always to be differed by 1/2 unit. That's the condition that is imposed. And in that case, this model has been studied forever. So in the early 80s or late 80s by these type of people and doing numerics. And then it was realized around 1990 or so that by Dar and Spohn and so on, that this maps, that the master equation of this process maps on the spin and half quantum chain and the 6-vertex model. And that's why we have an exact solution of KPZ in 1+1 dimension. And okay. So how do you map this on these driven diffusion problems? Now, it's very simple. You can characterize the surface not by the height, but by the step. This is down spin, up spin, up spin, up spin, down, down, and so on. Or you could say a down step is a particle, an up step is an empty side. And you get them basically one-to-one mapping. Yeah, and if you do the spin chain, actually, it looks like you discretize the Burgers equation by discretizing the velocity field in discrete joints up +1 and -1. But this is in the density language. And now the point is that if you see the absorption of a particle represents a jump to the right of a particle, and the evaporation represents a jump to the left. And that is unequal in the growing case, and that's why you have driven diffusion through the channel. It is, that is the asymmetric, because there is a direction. It is the exclusion process, because these guys cannot pass each other. And that is equivalent to the fact that these little slopes actually don't do anything. These are blocked. So actually, in this model, and the lambda term is actually negative, very strong, because sloped surfaces cannot grow. And so, okay. Okay. Now, if the surface was flat, then it would be half filled, because up and down is the same. If you have a density lower than half, then you tilt the surface. But you can just as well do that here, and that will play a role. And because the whole problem was faceting, you remember? So there are a few things I always remember when I three facts that come out of the exact solution and so on. Is one is that the stationary state is random, not necessarily at edges, but in the bulk, for sure, unless you have some problem. That means that these particles are randomly placed. That is the statement that the roughness exponent in KPZ is a half. The second thing is that the fluctuation, if you create a density fluctuation, it's like a wave packet that spreads with this anomalous exponent 2/3 instead of 1/2. And the third thing is that group velocity thing. That is, this wave packet actually won't stand still, except if the density is exactly 1/2. If the density is below 1/2, then it goes to the right, and if it's larger than 1/2, it goes to the left. And so you get a picture of fluctuating fluctuations traveling along the chain. And that's important because that will mean, for example, that the passage through the slow bond, and I will show you later, is uncorrelated noise. I will show you.
What half is it? equilibrium or not?
No. P and Q are, and P is Q, that's equilibrium. Yeah? P and Q is equilibrium. This is basically the density relates to the global tilt of the surface. Yeah? Okay, now so the beta ansatz solves it for periodic boundary conditions, as Herbert talked about 2 weeks ago, for example. But this whole system is extremely sensitive to open to the boundary conditions. That's the first message. Okay, and that is basically the message from the work by Derrida and all on matrix. They can write down these stationary states for this process with open boundary conditions and so on. But the message is basically that the system is extremely sensitive to reservoirs and edge things. And that leads to traffic jamming and all that stuff. And so the classic setup of them is a reservoir on the left with a chemical potential type parameter here, fugacity of jumping on the road. And here a different type of parameter jumping off the road. And then the question is, who controls the bulk? Okay, and the bulk controls itself if alpha and beta are large enough. Not going into details. So there is a phase where the bulk controls its own fate, like in thermodynamics and equilibrium. But there are also cases where this guy is going to starve the road and takes control over the current. So there is a phase where this guy is under control, and there's a phase where this guy is has control. And there's even a first order phase transition from this control to that control phase. Okay? And the other message is that there are then density tails. The density profile will not be flat, but has little tails. And with the things I just mentioned about group velocity and so on, you can actually qualitatively understand all the results that come out of that exact work. Okay, and now what I'm going to do is put a slow bond in the middle, where the probability to pass is slower or faster. Okay, so P prime.
An accident on the side of the road, or what?
Say it again?
An accident on the side of the
road? A construction site, like there, okay? The nice thing about traffic jamming is that it becomes cute. If these are electrons hopping in a mesoscopic system, then it is serious. If this is one of those fibers inside your cells, with these molecular motors walking on it, yeah, that is the other realization that is also serious, isn't it? So this has been studied, like I said before, if I had known all this, then I would have shied away from the thing, but I didn't really know how we were doing it, of course, I learned. So first of all, there's a mean field theory says that basically there is no critical point, that's the question. So R is given like this, here. So if R equals 1, there's no slow bond, and the question is whether immediately when the slow bond appears, whether there's a traffic jam. Okay, then there's early work by David Mukamel and Kando. They were doing a slightly different model, but they actually confirm roughly what we are going to say. That is a critical point. But that is the numerics is not that convincing. Lewis has been studying this for a long time with him and with Speer and so on. And although in their papers from that era, they don't really address the question I'm asking, they're talking about shock waves on the other side. You can induce from their pictures, and by talking to them, that they believe that RC is 1. That is, there's no critical point. Then Schultz. There is an exact solution by the matrix method, which I'm not talking about, in the case of parallel updating instead of sequential, and then there is RC equals 1, but that doesn't contradict what I'm going to say because the noise is much weaker in that case.
There's no direct solution to this matrix. Closely relies through random matrices. Different models.
Let's talk about a different. This matrix method, you have these matrix methods of finding exact stationary states. That's what you're talking about. I'm not sure. Okay, the thing I realize is that a method model that has that a solution cannot have a phase transition. because it's linked to an equilibrium process with an extra hidden degree of freedom, that is the matrix dimension, and in short-range interactions. So basically, each time I see somebody do the matrix solution, then I say, okay, that is not really interesting to me, because I would like to see phase transitions, whether they're possible. And so I'm not surprised he says it isn't there, because it is consistent.
It means that you do different models, right?
I do a slightly different model, which is intrinsically, I think, not solvable by the matrix product. I'm not going to the details of that later. I can talk about it. Now, these matrix methods only work in very special cases.
Where it's in equilibrium?
No, not in equilibrium. The reader setup can be solved with the matrix method.
You said there was some hidden equilibrium there.
I would say, if you think about the structure of the matrix method, yeah, it writes it as an almost like a path into transfer matrix of an open of a matrix. And there is some equilibrium system that corresponds to that, yeah, and that has clearly short-range interactions, and therefore there's no phase transitions in, there cannot be phase transitions in such solutions.
Yeah, there's a hidden equilibrium in the appropriate variables.
Yeah. Okay, and this is, I'm pretty sure now, of course, out of that class of models that can be solved by that method. And that's why I'm studying things numerically, actually. No, I'll talk to you later. Okay. So here is the same type of setup as Derrida. We have now a slope bond. At this point, you should tell me that I'm inconsistent, because last week I was telling Alan all the time to use periodic boundary conditions in his stuff. Okay, but the problem is, if you put periodic boundary conditions and a slope bond, then you get a traffic jam here, and you get a shock wave on the other side. And I don't want the numerics of the shock wave to interfere with what's happening, the critical phenomena that happens at the slow bond. I want to make it insensitive to the boundaries. So instead, therefore, I pull it open, and I'm tuning this alpha here to be 1/2, because I know then that I know exactly what's happening here from the Derrida's work, actually. So I have full control over what happens on the edge. And so let me show you this. These are some simple profiles, not very good ones, but. So I chose it such that if I have no slow bond, the profile, the density profile, is completely flat, with no tails here. That's what I did. Then you start to increase the slow bond strength, and you get, so this is particle hole symmetric, so it's not an issue. And then you see that here are, okay, this will jump into an, and this is an exponential tail. And I basically know that from Derrida's work, because if I block this out, I can create the same area here by a reservoir on the other side. So I can read off from Derrida's work what this part of the tail is doing, and I have it fully under control. Okay, now here's the general thing. So here's a generic profile. Now it's nice numerically, because basically everything of the profile is known, like, except if there is an offset, yeah, a traffic jam, this is the offset from 1/2. This is the tilt angle of the KPZ surface, and the localization length, basically, from the polymer. If there is an offset, then because of, I can measure the offset as by measuring the current, because the bulk dense, if this is really in the bulk, far away from everything, there should be uncorrelated noise. That means it will behave like that. And this is the density, is the delta. So the density is linked to the current. The jump here, the density, the first side, is linked to the current. And this is a correlation length that is also known from Derrida's work. And so basically, the whole shape of this is fixed, except for whether there is an offset, yes or no, and the little tail here, which will be important because of this thing there. Okay. So now you measure the delta in the Monte Carlo simulations. There are several ways. And then so this is the crucial data, basically. So it's the order parameter as function of R. This is a slow bond. This is the fast bond. And so here, this is at one fixed large system size, 4,000 or so. And these circles and squares are just measuring a different quantity, like the current, or the density, or the density at the first sight, that type of stuff. And if you look at this, then you're saying, there might be a phase transition here. Okay, but or maybe there's an essential singularity, huh? Which would be nice if this was at its lower critical dimension. But everybody knows here, I guess, that plotting is also an art form, huh?
So
that is the offset to the density. So here's the third thing. It's the order parameter.
Have you determined that order parameter?
No, that's why it's said that you do Monte Carlo simulations and you measure the current, a function of R, and you measure the this directly by fitting the profile.
So by fitting the profile, so you fit that
hole. You see this, so you fit in. Okay, I will get back to that part.
How many parameters are you fitting to the profile?
That is the, okay, in some sense that's the weakest thing, okay, because there are basically three parameters. So that's the most sensitive one, and that's not the one you want to rely on. But the current has no parameters. And the density at the first sight has no parameters. Things like that. And so here are these different criteria, and there is a little bit of scattering between them. This looks very reasonably convincing, but of course, if you plot this more, only this area here and only one of those variables, then it looks less convincing as usual. Yeah. Then the question is this going as infinite as scaling to here, yes or no? So now you get analysis. So first of all, let me dispel the essential singularity. Yeah, so is this an essential singularity that you do that by plotting the log of that, okay? And this should be a straight line if it was an essential singularity. So there's no essential singularity. Okay, that is the part of the contradiction with the...
That formulates a field theory.
Exactly. Then you start to say, okay, let's fit a power law through it. Yeah, that also, huh? And the way to do it is to just tweak the possible values of the critical point. If this is a power law, then if I choose the right value of the critical point, that becomes a straight line in a log-log plot. That's the point. So you try several version values, and then you find one that is basically almost straight, at least. And I gave myself.
Natural log there, so that's
that R. That is not that important, isn't it? Because it drops out. It is the slope. The slope is the bad exponent. And the point is now, if you. One interesting thing that seems to happen is that at the value that you're in this range here, I gave myself this error bar here. Because you have to be aware of correction to scaling in this game all the time, and that's why you just have to be careful. But at this value, the slope is actually 1.5. So this exponent is nice somehow, okay? It's a nothing in some sense. But then you're going to sit at that value, and you measure the finite size scaling of the thing. You measure how this at epsilon zero scales with the system size. And then you get a pure power law with a nice exponent, which looks very close to 3/8, although that is less clear. But that seems to be consistent. That scale, everything is, it's more or less a consistency check I can only do here. So I see a straight line power law fit, I see a nice finite size scaling, and then even I can collapse the whole thing in the scaling function with that value of the critical point, and here's the finite size scaling over an enormous range of system sizes. Yeah, so that's important because if there were a correction to scaling, then this would not, if you do this for the Ising model or even in 2D, I think, and at small system sizes, then things, scaling functions typically don't collapse because there's an irrelevant operator shifting it. So this is very good scaling.
What's the meaning of delta V over in the Schrodinger equation with the thinning?
That is this thing.
correlation by angle, right?
Yeah, that's the correlation, yeah. The inverse of that. Okay, now, so that is the evidence. Now, now I have an argument. Okay, now I want to talk about the tails. Let's see, we have it here. So here are the tails. And, okay, so the basic point is that I feel more confident on just in the merge because I have an argument to show that in that intermediate phase, this is a pure power law density tail. With a one value of the exponent. And here it is a half, in the sense of a formula like this. So y is measuring the distance from the slow bond. Okay, so this is that plus that plus a power law correction. And this is a half in the faceted phase, which I can argue. And when this is zero in intermediate phase, this is going to be 1/3. So now first.
I have a little problem. I mean, you know, is that CW of V minus C X to the minus 1 over here, right? So if this is really the behavior, C would go to 0 as R goes to.
Now this is that is basically this. On a naive level, it's Costa probably doesn't like, so you get something like this, isn't it? And then. So this is going then, and this is respect to zero tilt. So this is basically going as delta x.
Well, I want to look at the regime where r is greater than rc or less than one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's an exponential e to the minus something.
Yeah.
That little c.
That's a constant in front, which I call a there.
Constant should go to zero, shouldn't it? As r goes to one from below. And the field theory would say that constant should go to zero. The essential singularity is r goes to one from below. The field theory doesn't say anything about strong coupling localized phase, whether it's stretched exponential or not. It just tells you about the crossover away from the the delocalized phase.
So the amplitude of that is
It contradicts the field theory.
Okay.
Well,
that's why I'm talking about this here to see what you guys say exactly, but. So the C goes to zero for sure. The amplitude of that goes to zero when you turn off the slow bolt.
How does it go to zero?
I have it somewhere, but not here. So I have focused on that exponent, and so now you get profile fits. That's a very dangerous the three-parameter fit type thing. So there's a little bit noisy. So here is the fast bond seems to go to 2/3. Okay, Mukamel and Kandal in the 1990, look at similar things, and they thought this was a continuous varying exponent. But I don't believe that. But typically, because typically you have correction, you have crossover phenomena, and so I see more here in plateau at 2/3, roughly, here at 1/3, and here at 1/2.
So, can we define this exponent mu for the observer?
Yeah, so. Integrating, yeah, so. Let's see, integrate at once. Here you go from the velocity field to the height field. And so this is basically,
This is the next term.
In the, if this is non-zero. Okay, and so in the profile, so it would be like this. It would be have a little cusp here, that is in the KPZ. Yeah, that would be this cusp. Would be this. And I'm saying that in the intermediate phase, this is going like this with 1/3. So one minus 1/3, so it's going to be 2/3. This is the KPZ language, so this is the height, the function of x, and here is that little sliver that you see was overdoping. Okay. So let me show you, I think it is somewhere here. So this looks very noisy, but if you, but here's the, so here's a log-log plot of, so this minus, okay, of this thing basically. So this, the density minus the delta B, forget about this language, and that is a log, so this is the new exponent, this is the slope 1/2. This looks very good. This is very good because you're doing it somewhere, it's one of these points here. Okay, and then you take a point here in between, and you get this. Okay, and so here this is a 1/3 power. So if I if I'm not too close to RC, okay, at RC almost.
It should be 1/2 the KPZ.
Well, I will tell you. Okay, I'm going to give you an argument which shows actually it has nothing to do with KPZ.
But then there is no exponential localization. Then it should be over the square root of x, right?
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
So if you look at the exponent, it basically tells you what are the fluctuations of the height function,
mm-hmm.
right? And so fluctuation of height function should be square root of x, as in trapezium region.
But that is when the r is 1. And I'm not having that here. So I'm not talking about Argos 1 here. There's a crossover at Argos 1 to this behavior. This, without this.
R is not 1, but below transition, right?
This is, as I said here, below, but in between.
You make R just below 1, the behavior long distances changes qualitatively.
Yeah.
Again, the field theory just tells you about how you cross over from the KPZ towards your localized domain. So really, you should look at A. How does A vanish? If you want to check for the field theory,
okay.
does A vanish exponentially mm-hmm. in either minus
yeah.
1 over R?
Okay. Right. That's the one.
That's what the field theory tells you. If your guess for the phase
mm-hmm. Okay, let me try to give you an argument why it should be 1/2 and then 1/3. Okay? And that is sitting in this story here. But I better do this first. This doesn't work very well that way. So you have a profile like this with a power law here. So this is y, and so the delta is going as a bulk plus a correction. And let's keep it new. So first doing the case in the localized regime to give myself feeling that I can explain the 1/2. Okay, now as I said before, there is this group velocity of fluctuations, which is, if you shift this, is exactly, basically proportional to this delta. And the delta here, delta bulk.
And why is the distance from the place where you have modified the...
Is y.
What is y?
That is the distance from the slow bond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Call it x
there. No, but x is forward and y is backwards. Okay. Okay, so the group velocity fluctuations is positive or negative. Now, let's see, I have to get this right. So this is higher density, so here the group velocity is that way. And here it is that way. Okay, now what does it mean? It means that if the fluctuations happen at the slow bond, the density fluctuation, then it forgets about it immediately because that information is travels away from it. And so the first statement is that fluctuations at the slow bond are uncorrelated. And it's very interesting. So basically you're saying that if you have a traffic jam on the freeway, then fluctuations at the traffic jam are, don't remember them. And there's no correlation between them. Okay. Then the Let me get my notes here. Okay, the second statement is that there is an asymmetry in the density, asymmetry in the fluctuations. That means that there will be a surplus of particles near the slow bond. And because a high density fluctuation has more trouble going through the slow bond than a low density fluctuation. Okay, and so if n is the surplus of these particles, then this has to be proportional to an typical time scale times 1/2, because it's uncorrelated noise. To find the time, what is the time scale? Now it's a time of flight, basically, because these fluctuations, the fluctuations travel that way, and so with that group velocity. And so after so L, that's the system size, let's call this L. It's like the group velocity times the time of flight. Okay, so this basically scales as L to the 1/2. That's how many particles are in that area over here. Okay, now then you have to assume that this is distributed as a power law. And I cannot argue for that, but it's reasonable. Then it means that this thing, that the area of this is of course going as L to the minus mu plus 1, because that is the area of this part, that thing. And that means then that from this and that gives you that mu is 1/2. Okay? Now how does the 1/3 comes about? So it's the same argument, but now the group velocity is changing really, because it is going, this profile is going to zero. Okay, so here still there's a group velocity here, but it varies now strongly on y, because this is going to zero here. And so here the wave packet's standing still. You can see there. And here the wave packets are standing still because the density is exactly 1/2, but only here they are moving to the right. So the first statement is still true, and still true then therefore that the area here, that this area should be going as a time of flight to the 1/2. There's still uncorrelated noise here. But the time of flight is a little bit different, because you have to solve, the change in y is that group velocity is function of dt, huh? You solve this, and this is 1 minus that thing, basically, that is that curve, because the delta, the shape of this, so this is going as y minus mu. And you integrate that up on both sides, you bring this to the other side, you get the time of flight, which scales as L to the mu plus 1. Okay, so then you say here that this area, on the one hand, is simply going as L to the, like this. That is just straight integration of the curve. And on the other hand, it should go as L to the 1 plus mu over 2, because of the random noise, and the time of flight. And this matches only when mu is 1/3. That's the argument. Okay? And the amazing thing about arguments is I never talked about KPZ. The dynamic exponent of KPZ is not in the story whatsoever. That makes me have this ugly feeling that also my transition here, that the RC transition with those critical exponents are probably nothing, have nothing to do with KPZ maybe. But that's the story. Okay, now the final thing is that if you have a fast bond, then you get a 2/3 power And the two-third power, you can argue, I will skip that, with the, with, that's the dynamic exponent of KPZ. Okay. So that's the end of this part, and I'm out of time. Huh? So, question? So I go to the second part, or skip it, give a little break, or... So this is an older work with Chen Chan Chen, who is nowadays doing genome stuff at San Francisco. So, okay, so the reason why I will talk about this is because we have here a two-dimensional KPZ surface, and because we are studying surface reconstruction associated with a surface that is growing by KPZ, you get something like trap loops. And there is something about the distribution functions of lifetime of these trap loops that looks very uncorrelated Gaussian, while the KPZ surface is absolutely non-Gaussian. So it links in some sense to what we heard last week. Maybe. Okay. So there are two aspects then. First of all, we have to get what are the critical exponents of KPZ in two dimensions, which is that solving story. And I just want to go through briefly. So what Chen Chan was doing is he used two different models. The Kim Kostelitz model, which is when you throw down little cubes.
We generalize this to 2D now?
2D, yeah. I just draw one-dimensional pictures in. And the other model is the same bricklayer model in generalized to 2D. Okay. And the reason why the first part of the story was, the reason was I wanted to understand the skewness of the stationary state in KPZ in two dimensions and higher. So that was the topic, basically. And then we got ourselves into details of what, so how non-Gaussian is that KPZ surface, and what are the scaling properties. Okay, so we started doing simulations on reasonably large systems. And so here is, for example, the second moment, a function of system size, L squared is the system size. And then you, people start usually draw these log-log plots, and they draw a straight line and tell you that the correct exponent is something. And the first message is that that is a little bit tricky, because if you now take these two models that I just mentioned, when you look at the literature of the early 1990s, then people were happily claiming that that BCSOS model, that is the brick model, had a roughness exponent of this with an error bar smaller than the difference between this and the Kim Kostelitz stuff.
Do you believe the difference in error bars can be that small?
They were quoting, okay, basically the point, they're quoting, nobody seems to be bothered by it, okay? But when I want to understand the moments, then I better resolve this first. Okay, and the basic point is that if you make local slopes here, and then measure the slope, this is a log-log plot, so this is you can make a local estimate for the roughness exponent with this system size, and so on. And then you can have a function of 1 over L, you have estimates for the roughness exponent. And this thing clearly bubbles a little bit. Huh? And if you now plot to do a least square fit through this dumb stuff, yeah, which people do all the time, then you average here and you get a small number. Now, if you look at this stuff, and this is a little bit scattered because he took small things here, you average a little bit more, then you get a curve that clearly trends upwards. And now you have to worry whether this is going to 0.8, yes or no. Because the estimate, the conjectures by Lessig and Kostelitz, Kim Kostelitz, say that this alpha should go to 2/5. And so here are the question scaling in the two models. So here you see that this goes, has the Kim Kostelitz model has almost no correction to scaling. But this one clearly has. And now you get the consistency check. So can I make this go to 0.8? It is Monte Carlo data. It's not that accurate, of course. But suppose I force this to go to 0.8. What would be then the correction to scaling exponent, the leading correction to scaling exponent? And then you get 0.6. And that is, I'll explain you later.
the graphless exponent, right?
This is, yes. Since you know that the dynamic exponent plus the roughness exponent is 2, you focus on the stationary state.
The roughness exponent is stationary.
This is the second moment of a system with periodic boundary conditions in both directions.
Now, it's 2 alpha.
2 alpha is... But the,
so, on the distance L, the height function fluctuates as like L in power alpha, right?
Yes, but you measure the width, so it is the h. Okay, it was on the earlier thing. You measure the moment, so... So you take the height at a certain side x minus the average, and you square it, and this is it. This, and then let's see now, you put an n here or so, or okay. For, this is the second moment.
And this is x in power. And the answer is x in power 2 alpha.
Yes, and this should go as L to the 2 alpha. Now then you do the third moment, that's the one I really wanted. And then you see that the third moment should scale if the surface is intrinsically skewed with 3 alpha, assuming that everything works nicely with power counting, and that you confirm. And with the correction, the scaling exponent is much smaller. That has to do with the fact that the odd sector couples differently to the operators than the even sector. And then you do it again with the fourth moment, and then you basically run out of steam by then. Okay, and then you get the 4 alpha, and that works too. And the correction to scaling here, you see, it gets now a little bit dicey because it is, it is numerics, but it is consistent with still with 0.6. So the correction to scaling exponent in the fourth moment in all even moments are the same. Okay, so this is done. And this is more or less consistent with what you expect, because if you believe in Lessie, if Michael Lessie's conjecture, and something like that, the operator context content of KPZ is simple, there's many, only one operator, then you can do basically power counting on all the higher order ones. And so this, the viscosity operator actually would have done this type of dimension of 0.8, which is within the error bar of this one. And then if you look at the odd moments, then this guy should not couple to it, but then something like the square of the curvature operator should couple to it, and that is minus 2, I think. And then this one is consistent with that. So the values are reasonably consistent with ideas about something simple going on in the KPZ server. Okay, now then there was some other stuff that is, so we did the calculations on PCs and some nice computers in Taiwan, which were idle. Parisi's group had, after us, something, this was, we did it in 1999 or so. And so around 2000, Parisi's group has done numerics on a special big computer. And they, the data should be more accurate than ours, the statistics. I think the system sizes are roughly the same. But somehow in their analysis, they claimed that that's the roughness exponent is not 2/5, but off by 1%. But in the analysis, they forgot that the correction to scaling exponent in the even sectors and the odd sectors is clearly different in our analysis. So they analyzed the data, presuming that these two are the same. And by doing that, they got themselves in some systematic problem. Okay, now the non-Gaussian part comes from the moments, so these are the one important ones. So you take the ratios of the moments, and so you get in, here's the universal ratio of the odd, the third versus the second moment, and this is the fourth moment compared to the second moment. You see the two models agree about this value, with correction to scanning again. And so the amplitude ratios, this R4 seems to be, maybe this pi, and this I have no clue.
This is minus E.
This is minus?
E.
Yes, okay. This is numerology, okay. It's a fun game. But Okay, so this is not Gaussian because then they should be zero, but that we knew already. But also here, for example, they should be, was it three, isn't it four? Yeah, Gaussian. So it is not, it's a non-Gaussian fluctuating surface, and I think this is, I think, still where we are in characterizing numerically what the scaling indices of this thing are. Except that after this, and also the same Italian group published some distribution function. So here's the distribution function of the second moment. You take the second moment and you measure the distribution function. And then you get things like this, a function of dimension. And these things start to look like these things we talked about earlier, didn't it? Last week and so on. They use this to claim that 4 is not a upper-critical dimension, which some people, like Kai, will think it is. But I don't believe that this tells me anything, because suppose this was, say, 4-state pots in the old days, in 2 dimensions, where the transition becomes first order. And if you would simulate the 5-state pots model, say, then you would see tons of critical fluctuations, and the first order transition is hidden so well that you might not see it. Yeah, so there's no characteristic. So they argue that these distributions don't do very some lock in or do something drastic at 4. And there's a whole issue about whether 4 has is the upper critical dimension of KPZ, I don't know. Okay, so that's that part. Now, so we have a non-Gaussian fluctuating surface for sure. Huh? That's what basically the point was.
So there is no primary scaling in X in the position.
Yes. Right. And it seems to say that the operator content is simple. And there's nothing here going on. Okay, now this is an X. I don't know if you talk by X, because I don't know. This has nothing to do with this, huh? I'm not sure what you're talking about. With N, yeah.
You said that this, what, the duck line is Gaussian or something?
I will get to it, okay?
But what is the definition of duck line?
I will tell you, okay? So.
And so it was not defined yet, right?
Not yet, I'm going to define it now, okay? So I'm going to talk about, I put on loop, okay? I will first tell you what it looks like, okay? And then I'll tell you how it arrived in the story. So here is a line, like the, which follows the ridges of the surface. Yeah, so we have the local hilltops and there are the ridge lines. And this loop follows a ridge line and it closes into itself. So it isn't, it's almost, okay, if you think about directed polymer, it's maybe like an 1D KPZ. It's like a random walker that always walks uphill. This is the generalization of that. And so you start, say, in a 1D surface, 1D KPZ, and you put a random, biased random walker, or maybe a deterministic walker that always jumps up, goes up. Okay, now I chose the wrong valley, okay? Okay, and then after a while, it will sit in this hilltop and cannot go higher, so it's sitting there. In the meantime, the surface is fluctuating. And if you wait long enough, then and this valley will disappear. And so this will go to something like this. And then the guy will go to a higher hilltop. Okay, and if you do this long enough, then at least in KPZ, the random walker will end up at the highest hilltop. Yeah? And that has to do with the nonlinear character of KPZ. If you do this on a Gaussian surface, then it will wander around aimlessly and decouple from anything else. Yeah, so, and then, but if you do this in KPZ, in one dimension, then he ends up at the highest level. And then this highest hilltop is fluctuating with KPZ exponents. So then this guy is going to fluctuate as t to the 1 over z. And so actually in direct way of measuring the three halves in the KPC is to put in this random walker on the surface and just measure its fluctuations. Because ultimately it's sitting at the highest hilltop, and the highest hilltop fluctuates with one over z.
But I hope the highest hilltop will change at some point.
Yes, it fluctuates with KPC fluctuations.
Oh.
Yeah, so the point is you have enslaved this random walker. After it finds the hilltop, the highest one is slaved to the KPC. Okay, and this one is the same way. It's a loop now in a two-dimensional system. Okay, and this is actually an Ising loop, an Ising domain wall. Okay, and
say in the limit of viscosity tending to zero, would it kind of degenerate to a line of shocks? Or?
Say it again. I didn't hear the first part.
In the limit when viscosity tends to zero, would this thing become a line of shocks?
That was my question when you gave your talk, basically all the time. And we have to discuss that. I haven't thought about that. Because if you do this game here, then you see that you do all these rivers, yeah, of merging shock waves. And you can draw a similar river here of merging local maxima. Okay, and that there's an analogy there, but I don't understand. It looks like the dual of it. Is what I'm saying. Okay, so now this is a whole story by itself. But how it arises. Basically, what I want to know is whether a growing surface can have an Ising degree of freedom on top of it, which undergoes a true equilibrium phase transition, or any phase transition.
Why do you say it's Ising?
Now I'll show you. This is the way it was implemented. So the question was, it came from, give crystal surfaces, and often they reconstruct on the surface. There's a surface reconstruction. They realign, they regroup. And there are genuine, all the pots and Ising transitions that you can imagine can be realized as order-disorder transitions in the surface. Okay, and use in here's the famous example of the missing row reconstruction in platinum and gold. And this is the 110. It's an FCC structure, and this row of green ones is missing. And then here's another one missing, and then this period is 2. And so this has like an Ising order parameter on the surface. And okay, there's nothing new there. But then in the early 90s, I was studying how surface roughening interferes with this Ising type order. And it turned out that if you do this in a simple cubic type context, then the Ising order and the step disorder, the height disorder, don't couple to each other. And it's like you have an Ising ordering field, an Ising transition on a rough surface. If you do this on an FCC, like in the platinum and the gold surface, then it turns out that they were really coupling to each other in such a way that if the surface tries to roughen, it immediately loses that reconstruction order parameter. And on the fundamental level, it is nice because if they don't couple, then you have a transition with central charge 1.5, half for the Ising plus 1 for the boson field. But if they don't couple to each other, collide really, then you might think something new happens. But actually didn't. It was still 1.5. Okay, so but out of that came the idea that you can have a rough surface that is reconstructed. So even a rough fluctuating surface can have an Ising type ordering on top of it. Okay, now I realized that for a long time that if you take this Kim Kostlitz model, it's a nice way of putting an Ising degree of freedom on the surface. Because you only have to make the coupling constant antiferromagnetic. This is a nearest neighbor interaction between heights, and then if you make this one negative, then you start to freeze out that this got the fast probably. So you can have a step up, a step down, or zero. And if you make the coupling constant antiferromagnetic, then you at zero temperature you have a BCSOS model with always step up, step down. And then you allow zeros, no changes, and that creates little loops. And the order parameter is whether the even or the odd sublattice is even or not. Okay, there's a lot of detail here which I probably don't want to know. Okay, so here is the Kim Kostlitz model in equilibrium with here's infinite temperature, here's the famous Kostlitz-Taurus, that transition, the roughening transition, and here's called antiferromagnetic, there's an Ising transition into a reconstructed rough phase. Okay? So I said, okay, let's put the field on, the growing field. Question, is there a phase transition here? Is the Ising field still ordering or disordering? Okay, now then Shenzhen started doing the calculations, so he did simulations, and he found a nice peak in the order parameter, some parity type thing. Okay, for the entity, it's not that important, so I will go fast here. The susceptibility peak is nice, but doesn't grow as you expect. It doesn't blow up really the way it should be. And it keeps shifting. Then you say, now let's go really sit here and see what fluctuations in the order parameter are. And then you find that it has power law tails, which means it is quasi-critical. And then you start to look really carefully at what's going on. And what's going on is that these Ising domain walls are always created in the valley, in the local valley, like a little loop. And then very quickly, they run up the hill. Yeah, it looks like the random walker going uphill. And they run up until they get stuck. And being stuck means sitting on that facet ridge line. Okay? And then they are sitting there and are slave to the KPC fluctuations. And these fluctuations I saw here are therefore just representing the KPC fluctuations. Is it clear? Okay, then, now the question I of course want to know, so how long does it take for this domain wall to vanish? So we took the system size L, we put a microscopic single loop on there and calibrated in the stationary state. And then we asked basically, what is the lifetime of a loop like that? And that should be reflecting the KPC fluctuations, and that's the only thing I was really looking for. Okay, and then, so here's the distribution of lifetimes of the loop of size L. And different system sizes, 16 square and so on. It collapses. It scales with the correct KPC exponent, so that was what I really was looking for. And at the time, I didn't really pay too much attention to the scaling function. But so then what happened is that we put the paper on the web and so on, and then Zoltan Ratz emailed us too late actually to include this in the paper, that that scaling function looks very much like this one. Okay, and this is something completely different. This is a gumball in the top. For a random, that is a one-dimensional. It's now a one-dimensional random walk, yeah. And the width distribution. So it's like a one-dimensional interface. These guys calculated that. It's sort of straightforward, actually. In the one-dimensional interface, then you can ask for the distribution of width, and that has this distribution, and this is in the log-log version. And the question is, then how much does this one look like ours? So we put it in, and it fits very well. This you do a one-dimensional Gaussian interface. So you take this h minus h, x plus 1 square, or the grad phi square. Okay. And coupling constant, and then you just do the partition function in the probability distribution of second moments. Am I clear? Mm-hmm. And that they calculated, and that is this beast. And now we just put it on. There's only one parameter to fit, basically. The thing is normalized by itself, but you don't know how to relate x with time, so there's a scale factor in the time to make the slope fit. Okay, but basically this gumball distribution that's sitting here seems to fit very well. At the time, I did not know how to ask myself how this fit maybe in Whittam-Tracy distribution or something more interesting. Yeah, and I guess I should get back to it, but this one fits at least. So what does it mean? It means somehow that on this non-Gaussian surface, and that's basically the end of the story now, so on this non-Gaussian field, I have an object that seems to fluctuate like an one-dimensional random walker, and its lifetime is given by that. Okay, and that's basically the end of the story. I don't know why. It seems to tell me, probably tells us something, that KPZ in two dimensions is something simple, or maybe not, depending on how general these type of things are. And so it looks like it is in the same type of things as we talked about last week about spin glasses and turbines. It's something similar. So that's why I wanted to stop.
Is there any way you could think of approaching this problem analytically?
KPZ in two dimensions?
Well, this Gaussianness.
Now, as long as you don't have that field under control that drives it, I am not sure what to do, okay? Any approximation would make it Gaussian, probably. But the thing I don't know, really, that I start to wonder is that, so how well... So if I put in Tracy Whittam through here, would that be fitting too? And maybe some of the guys are better. I don't know. Would it? the weakness, of course, is this part of the curve. That is not too much data now. And the system size are not too big, but you cannot go much bigger anyway. So.
Z equals 8 over 5.
Yes.
Where was it coming from?
Oh, this one. But this was the purpose of the whole thing. So the question is, when does it collapse? And so I have this curve at different system sizes.
No, where did you take 8 over 5 from?
Oh, that is 2/5 plus.
Are you telling me that this exact results that should be 8 over 5?
That was the part of the first part of this section. I think that everything is consistent with that. That is the point from all this stuff. Yeah, so this is really going to 0.8, I would say. And I was arguing there that the other cases, what seems to deviate, are deviating because of correction to scaling. Okay.
More accuracy.
I mean,
8 or 5 is a rational number, and
yes, the
data, I think, is
that, and so here it is 0.8 within an error bar that is quite getting small, okay? And this is guessing, of course. And here, when you collapse the data, you have to use point, you have to use this number.
How difficult to do is a convexity relation, right? It's like,
it says that the lambda, that is Galilean invariance in the KPZ, in the Burgers. It says that the lambda does not renormalize. That's what it says. That's that famous name.
Okay.